All right, it is 9 minutes after 9 o'clock, and our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign resumes. This week, we're dealing with the topic of Indigenous rights and cultural appropriation, and joining me via telephone this morning, Chris Peters, president of the Seventh Generation Fund. Thanks for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Cliff. Yes.
Good morning to you. So I guess the first thing we just need to talk about is the Seventh Generation Fund. What is the mission of the Seventh Generation Fund?
Yes, Seventh Generation Fund for Indigenous Peoples. We're a small philanthropic organization. We provide small grant support to Native communities, more community, grassroots community organizing and sustainable development. In the United States, we have some reach in Central and South America and in Canada, and a few projects here and there throughout the world, working with Indigenous communities primarily. And, you know, we do the classic arts and cultural stuff as well, and environmental issues. And Seventh Generation Fund historically has been most noted for its sustainable communities and environmental work in Native country. I've been with the organization. Come May, it will begin my 28th year, and the organization is now looking at 40 years.
Wow.
And, you know, we have good sustaining power, a great board of directors that has national, international focus, and community leaders throughout the world have been a part of Seventh Generation Funds at the conceptual level and have advised us throughout the years in implementing programs. We are not an endowed foundation. Mm-hmm. We raise our money each year, has always been a challenge. We depend on a lot of individual donations and support from larger foundations. Okay. We have a firm policy not to receive any state or government money or from, you know, corporations that cause more damage than good in the world.
Is that to not be beholden to anyone?
That's the assumption from the mm-hmm. initial organizers. Is that we don't want a large dependence on government. Mm-hmm. A lot of programs are. And the swing of governments, as we will witness today, mm-hmm. Or possibly witness today, could have a devastating effect on the viability of any community organizing. And it also provides us an opportunity to venture out and support the grassroots communities that are, let's say, doing leading-edge work or on the front-line battles of environmental encounters with major corporations and oftentimes governments themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives us a little more independence, a little more latitude, and our supporters understand that we're not the typical organization. We do a lot of community development work, but we also do I don't want to call it radical work because I don't think it's necessarily radical, but work that needs to be done in communities to bring attention to the atrocities that are committed on Native communities and more specifically on Mother Earth, the vital systems and the operations of nature.
And of course, you know, money makes things happen, and that's a very vital part of what your fund is to help fund some of these things to make them happen. Now, the term Seventh Generation, explain what that means.
Well, our founder, the late Daniel Bomberry, he was part Six Nations and then part Echo Salish here in the West Coast. And the concept grew out of our relationship with the Six Nations Confederacy, or Haudenosaunee, folks, and looking toward seven generations as a planning concept, the phrase that we've used and has been repeated over and over again, but it's something that internally the organization developed, is that in each of our thought and our deliberation, we consider what we do on seven generations from today. And the next seven generations, of course, will think of seven generations in the future. So it's continuing that they will have some viability in the world, that the Earth's ecosystems will sustain them.
So Now, you talked about, when we talked about what the mission of Seventh Generation Fund was, about sometimes having to stand up to large corporations or stand up to even the government if they're doing something you feel is not right. What is the Seventh Generation Fund stand on Standing Rock right now?
We are definitely supporting the opposition of the Dakota Access Pipeline, mm-hmm. as well as supporting the opposition toward the two major pipelines in Canada and the possible pipeline of natural gas through southern Oregon and reaching the coast, which would dissect several of our rivers that we depend upon for sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are. We'll see more and more of that type of development in the future. When resources are dwindling at the rate they are dwindling, and as populations are growing as rapidly as populations grow, we'll see more adventurous, if you will, tactics of corporations to access resources, extract resources from the earth, and move it to market. And that's where we are today. Historically, there was enough resource extraction happening in isolation out of the public's attention. But as we, as the demand grows more significant, there will be more blatant efforts to extract resources and transport it to market.
So,
and I think that's the battle in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure it probably is. Is Seventh Generation Fund active in the opposition at this point, or just with them in spirit?
We are active. We support the three major camps out there. Mm-hmm. We have a relationship. We have within Seventh Generation Fund community-based projects. A lot of them are environmentally focused. That are not incorporated, and we bring them in-house, and they serve as affiliates. We have 6 or 8 affiliates in Standing Rock taking positions. So, they are frontline types of organizations. LR Inspired is the major organization. The founder, who is mm-hmm. Chase Ironhire, is actually running for Congress in North Dakota, and we'll know more about it at the end of the day on how his campaign is going. And he's taking the lead, in a campaign season, taking an out front lead to oppose the Access Pipeline. So, that's a big political issue in the Northern Plains, particularly North Dakota. So
that'll be interesting to see how that
we house them within Seventh Generation Fund, and we raise money and they raise money independently to support that campaign.
As I said, it'll be interesting to see how that one comes out at the end of today. So Humboldt County has got one of the largest Native American populations in California, at least by percentage of population. So what is the state of indigenous rights in Humboldt County at this point?
I always look at it as we're not talking Indian or Native American when mm-hmm. we're talking about tribal nations. We're talking about independent sovereign entities that function within the state, within the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And technically, if we break down the retained rights of tribal government, and those are retained sovereign rights that haven't been taken away from us, haven't been, haven't been sold to the government or usurped by plenary powers of the government. And those rights are still enforceable, and those rights are stronger than a state government, stronger than a county government, stronger than a city government, and less than a nation, of course, with this plenary powers issue. So those retained rights and retained rights to govern particular jurisdictions, and looking at those jurisdictions extending beyond reservation boundaries into traditional boundaries has always been a challenge. As an example, the Wiat tribe that we their homelands now have a traditional obligation to provide oversight, if you will, to a pretty large area, you know, including the town of Fortuna, Ferndale, Arcata, Eureka, you know, and whether or not the governments or the settler colonialists come in and take over, recognize that rights, is not too relevant, you know. It's relevant in the fact that they are occupying it, but in terms of this is we got homeland, and as much as we got assert that homeland concept, you know, eventually that's going to be a significant political issue in the future. The management of Humboldt County, as we all can experience, is first is a great environment, but the impacts on the environment over the past 150 years have been devastating, have been extremely devastating. We look at the quality of the rivers, we look at the forests, we look at land use, and all of that method of human management has been a major concern, and certainly not forward-looking to generations to come. And I think the assertion of traditional sovereignty and the concepts of a relationship to land and the concept of the earth itself being sacred, you know, is a whole different paradigm than what we see at play today.
True. Now, one thing we were talking about off air that I'd like to bring up, we were mentioning a positive step that that you were working on with the city of Arcata, a proclamation. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
You know, and actually, Michaela, who's a good mm-hmm. friend of yours too, mm-hmm. did some intern work with Seventh Generation Fund and did a lot of research for us and looking at how do we get city governments, county governments, to begin to offer up some accommodations to traditional rights, traditional understandings. And one is we're saying, hey, one day a year should be Indigenous Peoples Day. And let's not continue celebration of the conquest and domination mentality as put forth with Columbus Day. So, you know, about 6 months ago, we were talking in staff meetings saying, hey, we don't need to depend on the city of Arcata to declare it Indigenous Peoples Day. Why don't we talk to the Wiat tribe? Why don't we talk to other people and Native people? And we just assert our self-determination over the region and say, hey, this day is Indigenous Peoples Day. And that's what we did. And we encouraged, you know, cities, local municipalities, county governments, to follow along and do the same. And the city of Arcata was the first to step forward and say, we will proclaim Columbus Day no longer to be Columbus Day, but from this day forward, it will be Indigenous Peoples Day. And a small step, you know, in terms of that broader recognition, but in terms of the impact on where we would like to see this concept evolve is a major impact. Mm-hmm. You know, Indigenous Peoples Day brings along with it a certain philosophy of managements and certain concepts of how we would like to live in the world, and provides an opportunity, a platform, if you will, for Indigenous people to say, hey, we're moving too fast.
Now,
that we need to slow down.
Today, of course, is Election Day. Do you envision a time in the future where this may be on the ballot to officially change Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day?
I would hope that they would move that way. I don't think that's going to happen. You know, I think with the current, you know, I think one citation I've seen somewhere is that, you know, the thing that scares me most about today's election is that somebody's going to win. You know, And unfortunately, you know, the lesser of two evils is obviously Hillary Clinton. I don't see much changing in terms of indigenous peoples or native peoples in the United States, the policies that exist already. In fact, a little more encroachment possibly. Major encroachment would be evident with Donald Trump that we see. So, you know, it's do we choose a gun or a knife is a major issue for indigenous peoples and indigenous communities to choose from. So I don't see much change. I think, you know, as we look at the dwindling of resources in the United States and throughout the world, the expanding population growth, you know, we're projected to be 9 billion people sometime in the next, you know, 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. So the impacts on the Earth's environment is going to be major. You know, already I think some date in August is the point when the Earth's ability to be able to sustain itself is stopped. And after that date in August through the end of the year, human people are drawing on future generations' ability to sustain themselves. We're borrowing forward. And that each day, each year, that date gets closer and closer, and the more difficult it is to sustain itself. Mm-hmm. That's the reality, you know, and some people suggest that we're looking at if we continue this style of living, at least one other Earth, maybe an Earth and a half the size of the one we live on right now, to sustain this lifestyle. There isn't any.
And the population, of course, as you mentioned, growing at a very, very rapid pace. I mean, when I was younger, and this is my lifetime, when I was younger, the world's population was about 4 billion. And that's just in that very short amount of time has it grown to what it is today, which is kind of a frightening pace.
Incredibly frightening. Incredibly flat. And it's, you know, human populations' lack of or inability, and I think one of the recent studies is to comprehend the magnitude of what we're talking about is it has been, they're refusing to do it to the point where no action is taken. And if we look at it on a broader scale is how can human people continue on the path of suicide, mass suicide? And we understand that it is by force of nature that things will change, or by conscious choice of humans to make a radical change in our ability, our thinking, and our paradigm to voluntarily, intellectually, voluntarily, sit down and look at the future and say that's not the direction we want to go, and that we need to make a change. You know, we need to consciously make a change before we're forced into making that change. And right now, it from all indications, human population is unable to comprehend that, or unwilling to comprehend that, maybe is a better position. Mm-hmm.
So tomorrow we're going to be dealing with this more in depth when Michaela is on. But I wanted your thoughts on cultural appropriation, especially with regard to sports teams. There seems to be a lot of resistance with sports teams that have taken on Native American names. We just had the World Series with the Cleveland Indians. There's, of course, the Washington Redskins, the Atlanta Braves, the Florida Seminoles. Your thoughts on teams that take on names like that and their reluctance to change them?
I think the primary concern on appropriations is the mentality that people have to do that. You know, to perpetuate a stereotypical image, to diminish the reality of indigenous traditional knowledge and intellect to a cartoon mascot has some major concerns. Once we're diminished, once our regard in the general public is diminished to something that is insignificant, is cartoonish, then why would they want to understand and comprehend some of the issues that we bring forward? You know, it's the stereotyping of Native people is like other stereotyping is to diminish a people, and they've been quite effective at that. And whether or not professional teams understand the full magnitude of it is questionable. You know, they're at the local level. We see the Delnar Warriors, you know, and the use of that concept is a racial mascot as a mascot is a racist issue.
Mm-hmm.
And how they play that out is that they're not talking about warriors from any other people. We're talking about indigenous peoples as warriors. And so it's not only happening nationally, it's happening locally. And to a certain extent, California has taken some aggressive policy changes to say, hey, Redskins are not particularly to be used in schools. What about the concept of Squaw Valley and the issues around the racist concept of naming streets and towns and cities and locations after what from we determined is a very derogatory term? And it continues to do to happen, and it serves to diminish the credibility of indigenous peoples. You know, and the mascot issues is we look at the opposing teams as let's slaughter the Indians, let's scalp the Indians, the tomahawk chop, you know, all of that stuff kind of brings in you know, the not only diminishes Native people but diminishes it to the point where there can be violence perpetrated against us.
And the thing is that, you know, this kind of change, unfortunately, does happen very slowly, but at least there is some dialogue happening at this point. I know that, for instance, the NFL has, I guess, taken away the copyright of the Washington Redskins, but that has not kept them from using it. They still are using it because it's a you know, independently owned team, and they decided to keep that name. But it is, if you switch and you were to say, you know, if they were called, for instance, the Washington Blackskins, I think a lot of people would be very offended by that. So perhaps people need to step back and say, and not just say, this is a political correct issue. This is something that really needs to be addressed.
Oh, I think definitely. And I think, you know, that in racist mascot concept is a significant issue, but it's only the tip of the iceberg.
Absolutely.
Here, we're looking at a broader issue in terms of you know, we're not in the 1940s anymore. We're not in the 1800s where law and policy can be established to diminish Native peoples. We're in, you know, 2016, where there should be some more progressive thinking about justice, you know, and historically Native peoples throughout the United States and the world have been governed by right is might. There's no justice in that concept. You know, there's no justice in existing federal Indian policy as it relates to Native peoples. You know, there's some progress around the concept of self-determination. But self-determination, as we look at it being legislated, is the ability of indigenous peoples to manage federal programs that have been decided and legislated by the federal government, to be able to implement those programs according to how they tell us to implement them. They're not saying, hey, here's $100,000. You can do whatever you want with that $100,000. You know, that's self-determination. You know, it comes with strings, and most of the strings with federal, state government are bent around the concept of acculturation. You know, we can allow you to implement these programs if they acculturate your people into the dominant society. That's scary. You know, it takes away a concept of tribal identity. It diminishes our own traditions and philosophies and intellect and who we are as peoples to be able to melt us into the general population. So that's, you know, a human rights issue that needs to be addressed in the United States.
Well said. Well said. Chris, unfortunately, we are just about out of time, but I want to give you the last word if there's anything that we haven't touched on that needs to be said before we wrap up this conversation.
Okay. Well, thank you, Phil, for this opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think when we look at indigenous peoples, we need to look at a difference between civil rights, you know, which has been dominating American political scene for a century, opposed to human rights that indigenous peoples are bringing forward. Natural rights, rights of Mother Earth, and the connection of indigenous peoples to that rights of Mother Earth are significant. And the last thing I'll say is the idea of rights itself is maybe not the best term to approach these issues. Indigenous peoples forward in a concept of responsibility. We have a responsibility to that water to be clean. We have a responsibility to the forest to grow. We have a responsibility as human people to take care of our livelihood and to sustain life on the earth for many generations to come. And that's a basic human right as well that, unfortunately, our brothers have grown away from. And indigenous peoples have aggressively been forwarding the concepts from Standing Rock to Canada to Northern California to wherever those oppositions may be. They're forwarding a concept of the earth has rights and that we are connected to the earth as indigenous peoples, more so, if you will, spiritually, philosophically connected to the earth and understand the damage and impact of that desecration has on the earth itself and on future generations.
All righty. Chris Peters, president of Seventh Generation Fund, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. Very eloquent.
Thank you.
All righty. And this conversation will be archived up at khum.com. The conversation continues tomorrow morning at 9. Michaela Alvarez is going to be my guest, and we're going to be talking specifically about cultural appropriation. Thursday, it's going to be Ryan Jackson, that is the tribal chair of HOOPA. And then on Friday, I've got Chris Peters back here in the studio, along with Ted Hernandez from the Wiat Nation and my wife, Amy. And we're going to be talking more in depth on this entire topic in a 2-hour panel discussion in which you'll have a chance to call in and ask questions, make comments as well. And that is Friday, starting at 8 o'clock right here on KHUM.